I'm Jan Schaefer. I'm director of JLab. We're doing this panel because we actually fund a lot of hyperlocal news startups. We've funded 55 with Knight funding. We've funded another 18 under our New Media Women Entrepreneurs Program. And have taken a lot of lessons away from those. Susan Marnett is here with us today. Susan actually is the founder of Oakland Local. And she was actually one of our grantees way back when, but that's ancient history now. And she is really very experienced not only in running and managing a site, but also both in partnering with and competing with mainstream media in the Bay Area, as well as sort of analyzing the traffic and metrics on her site. And what we thought we'd do today is I'm going to start with a bit of an overview on what we're seeing in terms of the kind of journalism emerging from different models of news startups. And Susan's going to talk to you a little bit more about some of the mindset and the fit and some of the tensions really between news startups and mainstream media outlets in town. So what I'm going to do is sort of give you a little cruise through the landscape right now. And I think what we see is that there's just been phenomenal growth in the rise of hyperlocal sites. Lisa Williams, who runs PlaceBlogger, .com, over here, has about 4,100 sites she tracks. JLab has tracked about another 1,200, of which 600 are really active right now. So we know that there are at least 4,700 sites active, covering news and information in their community. Many of them have journalistic DNA because they've actually been launched by journalists who are either laid off, bought out, or want to be entrepreneurs in one way or another. They do a lot of breaking news. They do a lot of watchdogging of local officials. They're definitely filling gaps where there are no longer feet on the street left by mainstream media. And, you know, when you look at the origins, you get a lot of solo founders, but you get a lot of mom-and-pop shops where, you know, the spouse is actually the angel investor here because they're the ones working to support the site. You get a lot of small sites that are funded by community foundations, like you get in the Knight Community News Challenge. You get larger sites, like the Texas Tribune here, which has some angel investing money of some sort or some foundation money or a bit of both. And then you get kind of chains and what I call chainlets. You know, they're not quite patches, but they're Main Street Connects or they're Hamlet Hubs or in Seattle it would be Corey Bergman's Inside Media. You know, they're like little 10 or 12 site entities that work together. And what we see in all of this is a lot of hyperlocal news. Two of my favorite sites right now, DavidsonNews.net outside of Charlotte, is launched by a former Charlotte Observer reporter. He is doing hard and fast news in a college town of 10,000 people and making a living at it. He's bringing in, you know, a little over $100,000 a year, which supports him and his operations and, a staff of about two others with freelancers. He used to partner with the Charlotte Observer. He no longer does because the Charlotte Observer wanted to just pick up his content and run with it. And he really saw no reason to let the Charlotte Observer just have his content. And then the Observer said, well, we'll pay you $25 a story. And he said, no. And then they said, well, we'll pay you $35 a story. And he said, no. So right now he's got his own site, Davidson, and he's just expanded to a satellite site called Cornelius NewsNet. And this expansion into satellite sites is an early phenomenon that we're just starting to see in the news startup community. Newcastle Now, on the other hand, is founded by a group of people that I call civic catalysts in their community. They're not journalists, but these are the PTA moms, okay? They're empty nesters. They know a lot about the community. They know where the skeletons are buried. They know who's who. They know what the issues are. They have a lot of historical memory. And they're doing a great job in terms of funding hyperlocal sites where, you know, if they're empty nesters or kids are in college, they want to still be a volunteer. They end up being media volunteers, basically, doing sort of an active journalism as an active community participation. But very good site, newcastlenow.org in Chappaqua, New York. We're starting to see very much a real rise in university-based hyperlocal sites. And I'm not talking about, you know, one-semester classroom projects, all right? These are sites that are operating year-round. They're covering the communities around the universities, and they're doing news that traditional media in town is not doing. You look at Madison Commons at the University of Wisconsin, covering very sort of the poorer, less affluent communities than normally are covered in Madison. Intersection South LA, which is a UC Berkeley or UC Annenberg site, is covering some real tough neighborhoods around the University of Southern California and doing it on a daily basis. So these are year-round operations, and they're starting again to develop collaborations with mainstream media. Madison Commons used to have content that would run in the Wisconsin State Journal, and it would actually be branded Madison Commons in the journal. The other thing we're starting to see in this space, though, is niche news sites, and some of them are really fantastic. One of my favorites is Great Lakes Echo, which is a project of Michigan State's Knight Environmental Journalism Program. It's covering sort of toxic hotspots in the Great Lakes region, and it's doing it with a lot of investigative reporting, a lot of kind of breaking news reporting. They do amazing data visualizations and mapping of things in the site, and then they do marvelous engagement strategies. So if you poke around in their sites, they'll do things like carp bombs, which are photoshopping, you know, the Asian carp, which is an invasive species in the Great Lakes. And they invite people in the community to do very fun things on their site just as a way of engaging their audiences. On the other end of the spectrum is the Connecticut investigative health investigative team up in New Haven, which is also founded by two former journalists. Deep, deep databases on these sites, very big investigative stories. They're really only about 15 months old now, and they've actually done some wonderful investigations in which they are tracking doctors, for example, who are practicing in Connecticut who have lost their licenses elsewhere, stories that, you know, are taking a bit of journalism chops to do, and doing it, again, as both a grant-funded but also sponsorship enterprise where they're getting other media in the state to co-publish their stories to give them a little juice. And then we're seeing statewide watchdog sites happening in this space. Now, you all know the Texas Tribune in Austin, which is a wonderful, wonderful model. But I would point you to some other models, like the Vermont Digger that Ann Galloway runs, covering state capital news in Vermont. Very, very robust site. Lots of news, lots of information, lots of accountability journalism in a state where there isn't a lot of other journalism going on. And Oklahoma Watch, which is also an initiative that partners the Tulsa World and the Daily Oklahoman, two papers that used to be very, very competitive, but that now collaborate with this, as well as University of Oklahoma journalism students. Now, what we're seeing, I think, in a lot of these new startups is not only journalism that is a destination point that you want to consume, but we're seeing journalism that's an engagement point in which they really try to engage people in whatever the issues are, whatever the stories are, in a much more interactive fashion. So sure, social media will be some of that, but being out in the community, being a part of the community, being a member of the community, doing events in the community, you know, Evan Smith's quote that events are journalism rings true with this community. Not only are events money-making opportunities because you can get corporate sponsorships, but they're information opportunities because you can help people learn about issues, you know, in a Q&A or interview format. I think we're also seeing with these new startups, journalism is acts of collaboration, which entails a very different mindset than what journalism standardly does. You know, journalism usually is an act of competition. But increasingly, we're finding that we're creating media ecosystems in which the sum of the parts creates a much bigger whole. JLab has funded actually nine collaborative journalism projects with Knight Money right now, and I'm about to issue a report on that soon. And they range the gamut in terms of success. The two most successful are ones by the Seattle Times. The deal was, you know, we give you $50,000, you partner with five news startups in your community, and you figure out what the comfort level is for the collaboration. In the case of Seattle, it was linking out to content on these partners. The act of linking out to content that wasn't yours for a traditional news organization is heresy in many cases. There's not a very high comfort level with doing that. It's not a traditional mindset. In this case, it was so successful and it drove so much traffic to the initial five partners that have grown the partnership to 46. And, you know, it's very robust. They have a presence on the homepage of the Seattle Times. Very successful. In Oregon, similarly, they started out with 5 partners. They've grown them to 12 news partners. And then on a parallel track, they were doing collaborations with what you would call culture and lifestyle blogs in the community, the people who wrote about food, arts, whatever. And those two collaborations have now molded into one Oregon news network, in which the Oregonian is not only linking out to, but they're actually doing training and pairing up some of the news sites with buddy systems. I think that one of the more successful collaboration models we've seen is something that was funded by the William Penn Foundation, in which they did a one-off $5,000 reporting award. It was a competitive RFP process. You had an idea of a story you knew you wanted funded. The only hook was you had to collaborate on the story with one other media entity in your community. And JLab administered this program. We had money initially for 10 projects. The reporting ideas were so rich in terms of the journalism that we actually squeaked out money to fund 14 of them. And we've published a report on our website that you can read. The stories were just amazing. I can't tell you. I mean, we did page one stories on tax delinquent properties in Philadelphia. It turned out 20% of the properties were tax delinquent. $450 million was owed in back taxes. There were similar stories on broadband connectivity in the city and who had it and who didn't. And guess who didn't was mostly the low-income neighborhoods. Wonderful stories on education reform, wonderful stories on city councilmanic redistricting. And I have to tell you that this project had a quick turnaround time. We sort of called for proposals with only 8 weeks to think about it. So this is very low-hanging fruit in communities in terms of reporters often know what the good stories are that need to be done. And with a little incentivization, you can get them done. And in fact, do I pretend the $5,000 paid for the cost of these stories? Absolutely not. But it leveraged a lot of other assets. It leveraged the lawyers, the graphic artists, the web producers, and so forth to produce a lot of good journalism. More recently, we're seeing some collaboration around niche topic sites. One of the sites we funded was around the Marcellus Shale drilling that's going on up through Pennsylvania and New York. And so we funded the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette to do a collaboration with 5 hyperlocal startups in their communities. And it's led to this award-winning site called Pipeline. It's only a year old. It's just won a big Scripps Award. It's won an ONA Award. It's won a Society of Business Editors and Reporters Award to cover Marcellus Shale. So this is turning into being a sort of promising area for future collaborations. I will wind up by saying one of the differences we see from the new startups between new startups and mainstream is that there is a high ethical sensibility, but it's from building your community and not just covering your community. So that these new startups really do their journalism as an act of community, not just as an act of journalism. It's a different way of thinking about what your role is and what your mission is in your community. But they have very good ethical standards, in some cases even higher ethical standards than some of the mainstream journalists. In some cases, they have a comfort level for advocating for community issues where traditional journalists do not. Much more transparent, much more engaged in crowdsourcing, very mission-driven reporting. But I will end by saying that just because you have high journalism chops doesn't mean you live forever. And I think that what we have seen this year is some very high-profile websites go under, go belly up. Chicago News Co-op, most recently, newwest.net, wonderful website in the Rocky Mountains regions, just went under. Both very deep, rich reporting. So you have to have more than journalism chops to make it work. So I'm going to end there and then have Susan talk a little bit more about what she is seeing in terms of some of the mindsets and some of the attitudes that are happening in her world. Get you. I'm going to move this down so you can see. You can stand like this.
Okay, good. Well, I'm incredibly impressed that so many people showed up for this panel at the end of the day. When I got invited to do this with Jen, I was like, oh, this is great, free ticket. When I found out we were like the end, I said, okay, well, So it's really good to see everybody here. And we plan to leave a chunk of time to have discussion and be interactive. So I know there's stuff to talk about. I'm the founder of a hyperlocal news site in Oakland, California called Oakland Local. We started with a $25,000 grant from JLab's New Voices program, and our annual budget right now is only $156,000 a year. We do investigative reporting. We also do community stories. Our team is 75% people of color, 70% women, all from Oakland. It's a blend of people who are paid as contractors and volunteers, and we're kind of fighting to get to the next level. So we are not somebody with big grants or big endowment. And what's been interesting for me is that I think we're in a world today where, as much as there are scrappy little sites like Oakland Local that are very entrepreneurial, there are other sites that started before us, like Mashable, where you're really seeing a fantastic payout for new media entrepreneurs. Mashable may very well get acquired. This news just broke. And what I want to talk about is the tension between the perception of how much freedom or how profitable some of these news sites can be, where people work very, very hard, and some of the issues that seems to raise for some people who work in legacy media, where both the rewards and the demands can be really different. So, you know, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about journalists and new media entrepreneurs, and these pictures kind of set it for me. Charles Bailey was the longtime beloved editor of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. This is a picture of him when he retired. He died a few years ago. But he's the, you know, essential newspaper man, right? And then on the other side, you have Tavi Gevinson, who's a founder of Rookie Magazine, who's a teenage fashion blogger who has an incredible site that's really becoming a very good business, read not only by teenage girls, but by lots of people interested in fashion and style. And, you know, it strikes me that one of the challenges for legacy media is that for people who go it on their own today or who do a startup, that whole entrepreneurial spirit is so much more baked into the DNA than it probably was into the DNA of someone like Charles Bailey, who I'm sure was a consummate news hound. So, you know, the answer is that we're still in a transition. I went back and I found this quote from 2002, when people were arguing about bloggers versus journalists. And the wonderful Jay Rosen said, "Bloggers versus journalists is over. I don't think anyone will mourn its passing. There were plenty who hated the debate in the first place and openly ridiculed its pretensions and terms." That's really comforting news, but if you substituted new media entrepreneurs for journalists, I think you'd see that in some areas there's still a fight that's raging. We have great partnerships at Oakland Local with a lot of bigger media organizations. We work with KQED, who distributes our stories and puts our reporters online on the radio and pays us a pretty small amount of money. We're a partner with the Bay Citizen, where we publish there. We work with the Investigative News Network, New America Media, California Watch. We're distributed on Yahoo News, the Media Consortium. Partnership is really part of our DNA as a small organization to leverage, you know, our reach and get more exposure and also be able to do bigger stories, frankly. But we haven't been able to make a partnership with the local paper or with the local weekly. And there are other parts of the country, New Jersey, the New Jersey Spotlight, Connecticut, the Connecticut Times, Connecticut Mirror, and Housatonic River Valley, where they're really good partnerships. For Oakland Local, we haven't gotten there yet. So recently, we were approached by Digital First, who now are administering the Bay Area News Group. Our local paper is the Oakland Tribune, and they said, "We have a new community model. We're going to do community, community first, and we want to partner with you." Great. We'd love to talk to you. What do you want? What's the value exchange? Well, we want to give you traffic. And we said, "Well, you know, we're a little startup. We're very bootstrapped. We would really like it if you would sell ads for us or give us money to put content in the paper or pay us to train people. But, you know, traffic, for us to give you our content, we get traffic. We already have a lot of traffic. We have, you know, our problem is monetizing it." And they said no. And there was no discussion, no, well, how much would you want or how could we make it work? Just no. And we said, "All right, that's too bad." So I was in a discussion about financial models in a Journalism Accelerator discussion, and I basically put this post up. And I came back a couple of days later and found out that Jim Brady, the editor-in-chief of Digital First, had come to the site, probably had a tag for Digital First in his Google Alerts, and he put this post up back to me, and he said, "Ah, the reliably lazy legacy fail argument. A more mature way of looking at it would be this. We offer traffic, and you weren't interested. You asked for money. We weren't interested. No hard feelings or reasons for bitterness. We just couldn't come to an agreement. I missed the rule that says that any time a startup asks a legacy media company for money, we are required to cough it up." Well, I kind of went, whoa. I was like, what did I say? I laughed. Oops. You know, so I think for me, this is an indicator that without meaning to, I clearly hit a pretty big nerve for Mr. Jim Brady, right? Like, I have no idea why this was such a big nerve, but a hell of a lot of emotional language here. The fact that, you know, they never came back to us and wanted to talk further, that's cool. The fact that he basically turned me into an emotional woman, that's why I'm bringing this up today. A sign that the relationship between independent media, mainstream, not always so happy. Have no idea why. So, you know, when I was kind of trying to analyze why this happened, I sort of had to say, you know, is there some connection between the attitude of legacy media and the sense that new media entrepreneurs are profiting in ways where traditional media can't? And even though my site is little and I work like, you know, hundreds of hours or probably a dollar an hour, you know, do I have something that legacy media doesn't, like the freedom to innovate and change? So I think that's a really interesting question. And, you know, I think part of it is that Oakland Local and so many sites like us, from the really big Texas Tribune to the much smaller West Seattle blog, we have the ability to really innovate and try different kinds of revenue streams. So for us, we've come up with a revenue portfolio where we are selling local ads, we're doing sponsorships and underwriting to fund beats, we hold a lot of small events, we do social media training and consulting for clients with a group totally separate from the people doing the reporting, and then we rely on grants, both grants to fund our training programs and help us with our social justice mission, and grants for investigative reporting. When you look at legacy media, you know, I think that one of the problems is that people are much more locked in to traditional advertising, which is an incredibly challenging place to be, events which often become real estate or bridal fairs, and then sponsored content and advertorials, which I think are really getting, you know, diminished and don't have the same value in most places anymore. So I think that, you know, in some ways it may be legacy media that has the greater sense of frustration, even while, you know, I have the greater challenges in terms of sustainability. So I think that, you know, what I'm seeing is that traditional media does want to become more entrepreneurial. They want to move in the direction that they know they need to survive. But I'd say that, you know, what I'm not seeing necessarily is everybody doesn't have the skills in terms of having a win-win approach, being a good change manager, being able to collaborate, that it's really going to take to make these partnerships work. But I think that we all need these partnerships. So, you know, I think at some point, you know, whether we're dragged there kicking and screaming or we go there willingly, you know, the future of news is really about spheres of different sites that are linked together, from the really small city-focused sites like Oakland Local to bigger regional sites like California Watch to really big sites like the LA Times, New York Times, you know, whatever. And that means that we need to find ways to have collaborative partnerships. We need to have ad networks where we can share revenue. And we need to be able to find ways to share the audience that work with everybody. The classic models of traditional media, as Dan said, not linking out and trying to crush your opponent, you know, I just think won't work anymore. But I think it's really clear that we all just kind of need to grow to get there. So I'm really interested in what you guys think and in what your thoughts are that brought you to this session. I've posted these slides at SlideShare under my account, Susan Murnett, so if you want them, they're all there. Have at it. But really love to hear from you guys. You know, what's your experience been? What kind of thoughts or comments is this sparking for you? Christine. Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
And I know some people came to this session wanting to talk more about how to do hyperlocal. So I have some slides in reverse if you not only want to talk about the topic that we're here for, but talk about hyperlocal in general. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my name's Kristen Evans, and I own a bookstore in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. And our experience was that we had a really strong hyperlocal website started by a tech journalist in his spare time. And he was basically doing it so that he could get great deals at the bars. He said his social life really dramatically improved. His website was called Hateration, and it was sort of this lower hate blog about, you know, we're loving in the lower hate and, you know, screw those upper hate people. So it was really interesting because I saw how successful his site had been in terms of generating a sense of community in the lower hate. In fact, he has now told me that so many people have mentioned to him that they actually sought out and decided to live in the lower hate because of his blog. And it was really interesting when we were looking at a upper hate, Haight-Ashbury Merchants Association, about how are we going to get the word out about our events and the things that we're doing in the neighborhood. We realized that we didn't really have a way of really connecting in inexpensively. So I actually recruited Andrew to do a hyperlocal website up in the upper Haight. He needed, you know, some helping hands, so two of my staff members are now the editors, and they're getting very small compensation for playing that role. And I helped with the recruiting of local merchants through the Merchants Association to do the advertising for it. So I found it was a very interesting, you know, evolution of how that particular hyperlocal website came about. I know that we probably still have some challenges ahead in terms of maintaining the revenue stream, other things that will come up. But
what did it take to close an ad deal with your merchants? I mean, what did it take to get them to agree to advertise?
It wasn't that hard because so our Upper Haight Merchants Association is $200 annually to join. And he was asking for these two side ads there, $100 a month. And so, you know, it was a fairly low cost advertising option for a very qualified local market. So when the Upper Haight version of this blog launches, you'll see my bookstore branded there. You'll see other restaurants and bars branded there. And we just all felt like, it was going to be really worth it because we'd be able to tell people about author events, and the restaurants would be able to tell about Beer Week, and there would, you know, and restaurant events. And we just felt there was like a real obvious way to partner together.
Sure. So you kind of launched your own publication to help market what you were doing in the community.
Basically. And, you know, it's good that we have people that are outside of business owners running this, because they are also, he calls himself community positive. You know, he's obviously not going to piss too many merchants off, but I think he also, is mindful if, like, somebody gets a bad health report in a restaurant, he's not going to shy away from reporting that. So...
cool.
That's all.
Very cool.
Hi, my name is Ulrike Langer. I'm a German journalist, and I'm conducting a study about hyperlocal business models. My client is the German Newspaper Association, and they want news you can use. What can we learn from the American model? I want to make two remarks and ask one question. One remark is, two or three days ago, there was a Finnish guy in this exact same room reporting on hyperlocal or entrepreneurial models around the world. And he said, well, why do these advertisers advertise on small sites when all they get is a banner, a square, 160 by 160 pixels, and they're willing to dish out $250 per month for that? We could give them a much better CPM. But it didn't occur to him that it might not be the good CPM that the advertisers are after, but rather the connection with the community, or rather to see this as a stamp, we are supporting the site by through this.
Hold that thought. Do your advertisers care about CPMs?
So we have a joke at Oakland Local that if you know what a CPM is, you might be too big for us. We really focus on the local community, and whether it's a larger organization like the ASPCA or it's a really small organization like some of the ads you see on the left for the belly dancing and the local photographer or the club night. A lot of what makes people want to advertise is shared values. They also support the idea of shopping locally and supporting community. So while we have very, very high click-through on our ads, and we share our ad server reports monthly with our clients, we're kind of educating them about that. The initial interest is really in the shared values.
Yeah. The other thing is I also looked into the JLab network news model, and what impressed me most is what the Oregonian has done.
Yes.
And especially the fact that they took their $50,000 and invested in someone from the entrepreneurial community, Cornelius Swart.
He did a fabulous job.
Yeah, who's still running us, and that's to bring someone from, as German publishers would say, that's bringing the enemy into the newsroom. But that's apparently exactly what needs to be done. So, and finally, my question is...
And he just got hired after the grant ended, so we consider that a win-win.
Yeah. So my question to Jan is, are you picking up vibes from other newspaper publishers that collaboration might be the way to go and that those initial sites who took part in the project are greatly profiting from it?
Not all the sites that took part in the project are profiting from it, and we're going to be releasing a report this spring. I'm working on it now, that will say that there have been some great success stories, but there are some great failures, too. And failures that had to do with newsroom leadership, failures in which they required all the content of the partners be, in the case of Miami Herald, appear on the Miami Herald's channel rather than recognizing the independence of these news startups. So we'll be trying to offer some takeaways and lessons learned from those projects that we funded.
I'm Nicole. I actually work at the Journalism Accelerator, which is where that quote was from. And a lot of what we're trying to do is to help journalists, obviously, achieve sustainability. But I was just wondering, in terms of connecting with these legacy sites and proving to them the value in collaboration, do you have any suggestions as to how we could do that, or any case studies or like highlights of how it's been successful yet?
Well, as I said, we're working on that now. We'll be doing reports on the 9 pilot projects that we have funded. And we have published the Enterprise Reporting Awards, which is another model. It's what I call a cheap date model. You know, if you're only incentivizing collaboration with $5,000, it's not very daunting to do. I think that there's still, though, a mindset that, you know, the collaborative partners are not equal yet. It's like the big guys, the big J journalists versus the small J journalists. And that's where you get into this mindset that, well, we're offering you traffic. Why isn't that enough? When you're hanging on by your fingernails in some cases to you know, pay a freelancer to do a story. I mean, you owned the Occupy Oakland story. You owned it, right? I mean, other media were picking up your coverage.
Yeah, I mean, we're very partner-oriented. And, you know, when Occupy Oakland happened, we were in the middle of this giant national story because of a lot of the incidents of police brutality. And we discovered we just didn't have the budget to do the 1 to 3 stories every day. We were like, we kind of have to. You know, we kind of have to find a way to really do a good job covering this. And we went out to the community via one of our favorite sources to raise money, which is spot.us. We raised about $2,000, and that and then some other money we got from an individual donor, you know, gave us the money to really cover this. But our content was picked up by a lot of people, and you know, we were great with that. We're not looking for large payouts. We're just looking for recognition that, you know, we're a nonprofit bootstrap site who needs a little help.
Hi, my name is Michael Mason. I've got a touch of laryngitis. I apologize. I'm the founder of This Land Press, Oklahoma's first new media company. And we're a print publication. We just launched our TV show last week. We also have about 150,000 listeners on our audio program. We have a great iPad app. And we're for profit. So the Columbia Journalism Review did a write-up about us last year and called us the New Yorker with balls. And recently single this out as one of two examples in the country of being a really good for-profit, innovating journalism outlet. The challenge that we have had is that I think along with the accolades have come a lot of animosity from local media because, for example, the largest paper in the state, The Oklahoman, was also called the worst paper in the country by Columbia Journalism Review. And so this has caused us to have essentially a blackout among our competitors that they don't mention us, they don't link to us, even though we don't really have any bones to pick with them. It's hard to get wide notice among our community. We get a lot of international and national acclaim for our reporting, but it's hard to get the support back home. So I'm wondering if that's just an intrinsic problem to local journalism endeavors. And a second part of my question is I'd also like to know. It's always been my opinion that circulation is becoming an increasingly bogus value to sell to advertisers, and rather our advertising representatives are selling community and community engagement. So, for example, we have six times the number of Facebook fans that the local papers have. We're one of the largest social media communities in the state. And so we're able to monetize, we're able to basically compete against them for advertising revenue by demonstrating that size of a community over the circulation. I'm wondering if other people are finding out the same thing, because we don't get asked that.
I've never seen your site before. I think it's gorgeous and I want to spend time with it. We have exactly the same situation in Oakland. We have 7,000 Facebook followers, and they're very active. We have over 5,000 Twitter followers. We're the most visited Facebook page in the city of Oakland, and we've really scared a lot of people. So the other kind of thing that happened last week was the local weekly ran this article about what happened to the blogosphere in Oakland and where have these bloggers gone. And there were two things that were really notable about it. One, it was an article about blogging that had no links out. They did not link to anybody. Okay, so it's kind of that old school rule of we can't link. And two, they completely didn't mention Oakland Local, and there were all these other posts about this is full of crap, how could you live at Oakland Local? And, you know, we kind of had the same thing that I went to them and I had lunch with them and I was like, we should collaborate. And they were like, if we help you in 5 years, you could, like, eat our lunch. And I'm like, we're a news nonprofit. Like, how, in what form would we be eating your lunch? You're a print weekly with the website. You know, so we're just kind of toughing it out, and we have other partners like KQED or New America Media who've been great. So for us, it's been working with the people who want to work with us.
So did you actually, like, reach out to local bloggers to participate? Or?
Yeah, we have a number of local bloggers who blog on the site where we cross-post to them.
Yeah.
Because we have community contributors as well as professional journalists. So we definitely drive traffic back to local bloggers.
And do you ever hold, like, meetups or gatherings with
all
them?
All the time.
Really?
We have usually a meetup every quarter. We're doing something now that we borrowed from the St. Louis Beacon. It's the Oakland News Cafe. It's a events breakfast once a month. We've had 250 people at each one. Mm-hmm. We sound like we have a lot of values in common in terms of wanting to be a catalyst for community empowerment as well as reflecting back the good and the bad of what's happening.
You know, you might consider zagging instead of zigging. Instead of going after, you know, the traditional newspapers, you might go after public media. You might go after the blogosphere. You might go after the weeklies in Oklahoma.
In terms of
start networking them.
Yeah.
Start
Yeah, we do have something that is developing with small town papers, and we're finding them to be far more agreeable than large outlets. So. All right, thank you.
Feeling less threatened.
All right, so I have a question for each of you. So do you want them both at the same time, or should I do one?
Ask her first.
Doesn't matter.
Okay. So I'll ask you first then. I have a news innovation project that is a transmedia project, and as Susan knows, I made a pilot in 2008 for it. It's public radio based, and what I am finding is that there's an idea in the minds of funders and in the minds of potential media partners of what a micro news site or news innovation project should be, and it's very print oriented. So I wonder if you have any advice for me regarding finding funding or partnerships for a project that is public radio oriented. And I'm also curious about the range of media innovation projects that JLab has funded. Have they all been sites versus other forms of media?
No. I'm surprised you say that. I mean, Knight just funded what, the PRX Accelerator, which is public media.
But they want tech.
They want
tech angle.
Toys and tools.
Right.
I actually think that public media is a really wonderful partner because you get such an echo chamber when you're on the air, and people can multitask with the news and information that's in the community. So I think there's a lot of ability to make bigger media happen out of smaller media when you partner with public media. In terms of innovation, I think that, gosh, we funded everything from apps to, we just funded Aaron Polgren to do a comics-based tablet, comics-based journalism. I mean, so it can be many different definitions of innovation. I think that you have to sort of convince your funders of the value proposition of what, and funders usually like to see distribution. Mm-hmm. They're going to fund something. They want to see it on, have a lot of legs, be on a lot of platforms.
I see. Okay. So then that brings me to my question for you, Susan, which is that one of the things that I found, you know, I made this pilot in 2008. I'm working on actually launching the show itself now. And a lot of the talent that I had working with me, the independent freelance reporters, have been kind of poached by larger media organizations. And ironically, one of the people that will be one of our partners is KQED, and we will be probably distributing through KQED Independence, which is a program that I set up for them when I used to work there, for independent producers. So what I'm wondering about is how you decided, yes, we'll work with KQED without directly selling our content, but we want to sell our content if it's going to the Oakland Tribune, like how you're navigating that space and how you keep, you know, like people that are working for me are now also filing for KQED and filing for Bold Italic and Ocean Beach Bulletin and all these other sites. So it's kind of like I spent all this time finding the talent and developing it, and now the larger media organizations, Bold Italic's funded by USA Today. And so they certainly have the money to take those people away.
That's a great question. So Oakland Local has a team of about 15 people who are the core writers, and maybe six or eight of us people are people who've had professional journalism experience as opposed to people who like to write in other formats. And what we try to do is find people that we can give work to repeatedly. So it's kind of like a movie crew where you keep booking people on the shoot, you know, but it's a day rate. And kind of the understanding is that those people are not going to write about the same topics for other people. You know, they're welcome to freelance. Some of them write for local patches. We don't have one in Oakland, but they write for adjacent ones. I'm totally good with that because I don't have the money to give them a staff job. But if they were writing about the same beat for other people and they were a regular writer, you know, I would be upset. Having said that, we have people who've written for us who've gotten and written for all the other local media, and I'm perfectly good with that. I mean, part of what I think we can do for people is help them grow as journalists. So, you know, I don't think they're my writers and nobody else's. I'm kind of really open about that. And as for who do we decide to partner with, we'll pretty much partner with anybody.
You did get paid by KQED.
We got paid $4,000 to partner with KQED through a grant they got from Jan. But, you know, I think it's very hard. I mean, if you can get the Oakland Tribune to pay you for stories, I'm going to ask you to tell me how to do it. I mean, you know, I think that it's going to be very challenging to have someone who's a traditional journalist decide that your work that's produced in a different way has enough value to meet their standards, even if you're winning prizes for it. So I think that's a whole other, you know, question of value that, as Jan said, can be challenging. But we work a lot with students from community colleges and from Mills College, which is a local women's college. And, you know, we don't always go to the people in the J School, most obvious suspects. And we've gotten some great writers and people that we've, you know, helped move on to other jobs or get into competitive grad programs or get scholarships. You have to look at it as kind of a value continuum that you may not have a lot of money to offer them, but you're definitely helping them grow. And that's part of why they want to work hard for you.
And they're helping you grow.
Yes. Hi. My name is Shireen. I have a question, and this may be very specific to the area in which I live. When the local bloggers were trying to partner with some of the larger media, one of the challenges that we were having there was that, and this included Politico, who has like this branch called TBD that's supposed to be sort of the representation of the hyper-local. By the time they came into trying to get those local bloggers together, they were going after what we call the new resident bloggers, versus the existing bloggers and local newspapers that have been, you know, even the very local newspapers that had been there. And the challenge there was that the stories that they were wanting to hear from were basically from the voices of the new residents and what we call the transitional residents of D.C., whereas those that have been writing and been in this, you know, in that space for 20 years or so, they were not interested in that. And how to deal with that kind of, it caused a lot of tension, let's just say, and how to deal with how to get those bloggers who were already sort of there being visible and getting these local media houses, I mean, not local, but the larger legacy media houses to look at them as assets, even though in that instance it was just about linkability and getting their, you know, voices out there.
We've had a lot of those issues in the Bay Area and Oakland, as you probably know, and part of the issues in Oakland can add to issues of gentrification, race, and class, where people who are more upscale and more middle class and better consumers may be perceived as having things to say that are more interesting. And when we started Oakland Local, one of the people on the team was a longtime Oakland resident. I had moved there fairly recently from another part of the Bay. People were kind of like, who are you? You know, are you one of these people who are going to be here for 2 years and be one of these, like, you know, hipsters, big derogatory word in Oakland, and leave? And, you know, part of the way we cope with that is we made a very deep effort to not only have people work for us who were Oakland residents, but people who were long-term residents in the community. And I'm proud to say that we were able to have a lot of writers who were actually young African-American men of color, which was a demographic that was not always represented in media as some of our regular writers. So we worked really hard to build ties through people who were long-term community residents that we had, and to really try to bring in people who really had a diversity of voices. So one of our bloggers is a 68-year-old woman, lived in East Oakland her whole life, runs a political organization, blogs a lot about her views about the police, which are strong. We have a young man who recently graduated from Howard, came back to Oakland, and has been working for us part-time while doing other things. And he just got into the J School at UC Berkeley, and he's going to go next year. So, you know, we try very hard to make sure that we're reflecting the whole community. We also have people who are recent arrivals who want to write about things like, you know, the new barbershop, you know, with the mutton chop, you know, whiskers, you know, in Temescal, which is a more upscale neighborhood. And we kind of want to reflect everybody, but I think that's actually a valid issue. And the other side of that issue, which I didn't know about when I moved to Oakland and my co-founder Quan Booth taught me about, is just the way there are people whose voices feel overlooked. There are community organizations that never became nonprofits because their founders didn't have college degrees. So there are people who started community organizations but then go on to become really well-founded, rich nonprofits, and these people are still in the community doing great work, but they're scraping by. So we also made an effort to try to make sure that the organizations we were covering were really diverse in terms of the level of funding and who the founders were, not only what the work they were doing was.
But I would add to that that even as a small funder in this arena, I think when we funded you, we got some pushback on why we hadn't funded other Oakland news outlets. Well, the simple answer was they didn't apply. They didn't apply for the funding. But, you know, we got accused of bias for not funding them.
Yeah, and I understand that. But TBD did something interesting. I mean, they did invite the bloggers, but they invited a class of bloggers. So it wasn't, they were opening the door, but they, the invitations went to specific.
Right.
I think it's also important to try to see everybody. And if somehow you didn't see everybody, to be really open to many made a mistake. But there are more people who should be included who weren't, and then correcting that, you know, and that's a lot of, I think, our credibility is that we're trying to do things with the community, not for them.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, I'm Xavier. I'm the co-founder of Storyfy. So I was wondering, so first, thank you very much. It's great to see this new way of thinking about local, covering what's happening locally. And I think it's a new way of thinking, and I think that it also kind of requires new technologies, and I think that's great that we are now living in this age where there are so many hackers developing new technologies. And you mentioned Spotters, and also, I mean, I think that my point is more about, like, I really think that those things need to really work with those new technologies. So we mentioned Spotters, but there's also Kickstarter, for example, that can be really useful. I just saw that recently in the Bay Area there was a great project on Kickstarter. But also, like, today I went to the startup competition with the news category. There is, you mentioned about advertising, there was AdGlue that might be also useful. That might be also a different model that is more like directly targeted and not CPM based. And so I think, like, my point is more, I also maybe asking, like, what are the tools that you use and what are the tools that, you know, can really help? How can you make the internet work for you and really help achieve your goals? And I think there is a tremendous opportunities there. And we would love to hear feedback. I mean, also, you know, from Storyfy, we would love to hear your feedback on how we can achieve basically what you want to achieve.
This week. Susan is a tools queen.
Perfect.
So you probably know I love Storyfy.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
He planned this.
Yeah.
Because we can't cover everything ourselves, things like Storyfy, where you can collect things from the social media sphere and annotate it, are really huge for us. So, you know, we not only have done things like cover Occupy Oakland in a way that brings in other voices, but we've covered things. Pop Life, a teen group from Oakland, was a finalist in one of these, you know, America's Got Talent shows. And I sat on my bed in a hotel room in some city and live blogged the finals using Storyfy. And, you know, people in Oakland went crazy. So, you know, we look at tools a lot. We use Scribd an incredible amount because we're always putting up government documents. We think Oakland practices security by obscurity. So we pull out things from the city files and we put them on Scribd and we embed them in our stories and they get tons of downloads. And we use SlideShare. And I always put up my presentations on SlideShare. And we use a lot of virtual tools. We do a lot with Google Docs and in the cloud because our team is everywhere. So we maintain a news budget on Google Docs and a spreadsheet. We edit stories in Google Docs. I'm a Basecamp fanatic, but a lot of my team like free versions like Podio. So we're very much, I've actually written about tools. If you go look for me and find tools, this is a topic I talk about a lot because for news entrepreneurs without a lot of money, these are big problems. Like, what are the things you can work with? And of course, you guys all know about like TweetDeck and Hootsuite, but a lot of people who are like our advertisers, they don't have a clue. They're like, how do you put up those posts without sitting there all day? We schedule, you can do that? You know, they're kind of like shocked. So does anybody else have a favorite tool I haven't mentioned?
One of the things that we've learned, we just finished doing a survey on audience engagement issues, and we had some 270 news startups respond. And one of the tools that clearly they didn't have yet in their toolbox was good ways to measure audience conversion. In other words, they can tell you how many visitors are coming to their sites, how many uniques, how many page views. What they don't know yet from the data is how many of those visitors are loyal visitors that keep coming back. How many of those visitors can be converted to donors or subscribers? How many of those visitors can be converted to advertisers? How many can be converted to Facebook you know, fans or whatever. And it is crucial in terms of sustainability. That kind of data for a small website is really important to know so that you can begin to act on building a longer-term sustainability plan. So,
on that one, there was another one that I saw this morning that was called Humble. That might be interesting. I think also one of the things is, as an association, is also like if you can have deals with those companies so that all the local, you know, sites can actually benefit from those platforms. I mean, because I know Humble asks for money, so but those are the kind of things that I think is great. I mean, I think that really it's exciting times to have all those tools, and if it can really help mm-hmm. you achieve what you want to achieve, is great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I also like Amplify. I don't know if you've heard of it.
How much of the success and excitement and trust in hyperlocal is because you're not part of the traditional news media? Like, if you were doing exactly the same stories, exactly the same work with exactly the same people as part of whatever the local Oakland paper is, would you have the same level of success, connection with the community, that kind of thing?
Well, I actually think we'd have a much bigger level of success.
Really?
Because I'm a data geek. I work for a lot of big tech companies, and I love to use numbers. So I've actually run a lot of numbers for, like, what the, you know, what's our per-user ROI in terms of our budget and our page views. And, you know, with the money we have, you know, if we had the budget of the Bay Citizen, we would have like you know, 2 million users a month. They have like 200,000. We have like 70,000. So I really do believe that, you know, with more assets, we could do more. But I think a really profound difference is that we see ourselves as us. We're all us. We're not us and them. So we don't have reporters who drive in from the suburbs. We don't have reporters who don't want to have this job anymore, but they need the paycheck. You know, we have the opposite problem, which is that we're going to burn out if we can't get more money to sustain ourselves. But nobody's lacking in passion and a sense of mission. So, you know, I would like to think that if we were a better-funded organization, we could bring some of the same principles of really listening to the community, really being fair and balanced, you know, being nonpartisan, but being very grassroots, you know, to the table, and that would, you know, make us more successful. On the other hand, I think legacy media has a lot of issues to overcome that, you know, are very challenging. You can see that because so many organizations want to change. I mean, I personally love the story of Atlantic Monthly. I love the fact that Atlantic Monthly 5 years ago was kind of in trouble, and now they're like this digital god, right? They're hiring staff, they're adding people, they have a tablet app, they totally reinvented themselves. So I think that's proof that you don't have to have a giant budget to kind of think smartly and make it work. I think the Atlantic Monthly has done a brilliant job of reinventing that brand and keeping it alive. But, you know, then there are the dozens and dozens of newspapers where there's a lot more rhetoric than there actually is the ability to change. And I feel sad about that, because they employ a lot of really great people.
I would add to that that I think that we're seeing all this entrepreneurial news activity challenging some of the what were considered sacrosanct conventions of traditional journalism, this sort of sense that we had to be dispassionately objective about everything. Well, really, most of these entrepreneurial news sites aren't dispassionately objective. They're fair and, you know, balanced to a point, but they care about the community.
Correct.
And they will advocate for the good of the community, maybe not for a particular side, but for participation in community life and for the good of community. They might feel a higher comfort level for having emotion in their stories, and I think your traditional journalists really squirm with emotion. We don't feel comfortable there. I think there are some conventions that are being revisited and reinvented, really.
The other thing that's really interesting is we're not afraid to do small stories. Sometimes my reporters don't want to cover the stories I want them to cover. You don't pay people a lot, they actually could say, I don't want to do that, right? So, like, this story that I put up on the screen, this is a local coffee shop called Farley's in downtown Oakland, which is having a big nightlife resurgence. And Farley's changed its closing time from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., and they're going to start doing a lot more events and programming. And You know, this to me is a very community weekly kind of story. It's not hard-breaking news. Probably 2,000 people will read this story this week. You know, people are avidly interested. Like, if you don't go to Farley's, your friend doesn't tell you, how would you know that this popular coffee shop is open? You would not know. So, you know, we fill a place not only in kind of, you know, revealing issues at City Hall or what's happening with toxicity in West Oakland, these really kind of little simple stories that people just don't cover anymore. You know, and we try to figure out, well, which of those stories should we actually be writing up for, because someone's going to want to hear it. Yeah.
How do you see those stories? How do you get to know that this shop, they contact you?
At this point, we're 2.5 years old. We get a huge amount of tips. We subscribe to thousands of mailing lists. We search a lot on Facebook, just everything.
We've got a wrap. I'm sorry. Thank you. You've been a great questioning audience, and we really appreciate it.